Let me read that again. So this is John Eldridge in his book, Epic. Life unfolds like a drama. Each day has a beginning and an end. There are all sorts of characters, all sorts of settings. A year goes by like a chapter from a novel. Sometimes it seems like a tragedy, sometimes like a comedy. Most of it feels like a soap opera. Whatever happens, it's a story through and through. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Our lives are like stories. And some of our chapters are comedies, some of them are tragedies, some of them are soap operas. But the same is also true about churches, right? How many of you are in a church chapter that's a comedy right now? Absolutely. Okay, maybe one, maybe two. All right. Congratulations. How many of you are in a church chapter that is a tragedy right now? All right, well, that's good. How many of you are in a church chapter that is a soap opera? Yeah, there we go. A little more hands going up. Some drama going on. And of course, one of the problems that we face as church members and church leaders, as churches, is that we often miss the larger story that we're a part of because we're so fixated on the chapter or the page or the sentence that we're currently in. N.D. Wilson writes this in his book, Death by Living. Each of us is in the middle of a story, but for some reason we don't show the slightest desire to read it, let alone live with any kind of humble self-awareness. That's true for our lives. We're in the middle of a story, and sometimes we miss that larger part of the story. We don't show the slightest desire to read the larger story that we're a part of. We don't show any humble self-awareness of that larger story. And it's certainly true for churches. Churches have very short attention spans. They're only able to focus on a few things at once. And so we often get fixated on one chapter, one sentence, one event, and we forget the larger story that we're a part of. So what I want to do in this class is I want to share a bit of the larger story of the church where I preach, the Highland Church in Memphis, Tennessee. We're far enough removed now from these chapters that I want to share that I think we have some good perspective on them. We can see the context, the larger story that these chapters are a part of. I think we've gained some humble self-awareness about these chapters that now we're able to reflect on them and hopefully share some things that would benefit you. As I kind of summarize this first part, it was just kind of summarizing the chapters of our story, the Highland Church, that I want to share. I'm going to do so in a way that violates some of my highest values, because it runs against some of my highest values to talk about churches using the famous or the infamous B's: budgets, baptisms, buildings, bottoms, attendance. But, you know, sometimes those B's can be helpful to help us get a picture of what's going on in a church. So three chapters from the larger story, the Highland Church. Highland Church started in 1928. These are three chapters, three very important chapters in the life of that church. From 1986 through 2006. So 20-year period, two strong, great decades. Consistent, steady, solid growth from about the 700s to about the 1300s. So over those 20 years, a growth of about 600 total members. Just a fantastic time, glory years of the Highland Church, 1986 through 2006. From 2006 to 2010, how many years is that? How many years were we looking at before? 20 years, 600 members. 4 years, 600 members. So in 4 years, we lost what it had taken us 20 years to gain. We went from about the 1300s back down to the 700s in a period of 4 years. And then, from 2010 to the present, we've rebounded, we've turned around, we've recaptured some of that growth and gone from about the 700s to about 1,000, a growth of about 300. So these three chapters are what I want to talk about. George Barna calls this kind of phenomenon growth, decline, growth. He calls that a turnaround. In his book, Turnaround Churches, he says this. I know it's hard to see. When a church takes a nosedive in attendance or membership, so we have 4 years of nosedive, it generally does not make a comeback. The typical experience seems to be that once a church loses its momentum, the most probable outcome is either death or stabilization at a smaller size. So that's statistically speaking, when a church moves into that growth decline, it's going to either die out or stabilize at a smaller size. And thankfully, God allowed us to experience what Barna calls a turnaround, where you escape that statistical probability of death or restabilization at a smaller size. We've been able to rebound thanks to the grace of God. And thankfully, we've been able to rebound it without firing me. Barna says, in every one of the churches we explored, so that's a big statement, in every one of the churches we explored, a new pastor had to be brought in to create the climate and plans for an effective resurrection of the congregation. So thankfully, we were not every one of the churches that Barna explored. And it's been a privilege and a pain to preach at Highland through some of those years of growth, those 20 years of growth, all of those years of decline, and all of the years of the rebound. So Barna calls that a turnaround. Tom Rainer calls that a breakout. Churches that have been in decline or plateau and then they experience a change in momentum and experience growth again. Rainer, in his book, Breakout Churches, they looked at 50,000 congregations and they found only 13 who experienced true breakout, who experienced a real rebound in growth again. So we've been blessed to experience at least these 4 to 5 years of turnaround and breakout. And that's what I want to talk about. We're an old church, started in 1928 as part of a gospel revival held under a tent. Mm-hmm. Just a handful of people after that revival said, let's start a church here. So we are an old church. We are an established church. And we've experienced a turnaround. We've had growth. We've had decline. We've had growth again. How many of you are in an established church versus, you know, a church plant of 3 or 4 or 5 years? All right. So what I hope here is that some of the things that we've learned are applicable to you. That some of the things that we've learned about experiencing turnaround in an established church might be applied in your own situation. Not everything at Highland. I'm using the word reinvention. Barna says turnaround. Rainer calls it breakout. I'm using the word reinvention. I do want to say here that not everything at Highland needed to be turned around. Not everything at Highland needed to be reinvented. We had two very long-term preachers, Harold Hazlett, who began preaching in 1968 at Highland, and Harold Schenck, who began preaching in 1986 at Highland. A number of other preachers as well. But great leaders like that wove wonderful DNA into the Highland Church. And in many ways, our rebound, our turnaround, our breakout was the result of a lot of the work that they did all the way from 1968 and forward. So when I talk about the reinvention of Highland, in no way do I want to cast any shadow on the wonderful work of tremendous godly leaders that have been at Highland in the past. But clearly, when you go through 4 solid years of decline, something's got to change. And that's what I want to talk about. One final note. A lot of churches experience this. A lot of churches experience decline. And there are a lot of reasons why churches experience decline. But sometimes it's something that's been building up over several years, and it finally snaps and the church starts to decline. Sometimes it's just something that happens quickly and all of a sudden things are spinning out of control and the church is in decline. I'm not as interested today in looking at the causes of church decline as much as I'm interested in just sharing kind of how we rebound it. Now I will briefly say what is behind this for Highland. Two things. Number one, long-term preaching minister, Harold Schenck, in 2006. Left Highland to pursue a career in higher education. He's now the president of Ohio Valley University, doing a great job. It's a great school. But we went through that leadership transition, and churches that go through leadership transition often experience decline. That happened to be the same year that we announced that we were relocating. 20 years of consistent, steady growth on a campus of about 11 acres in the middle of Memphis had created a situation where we have 4 Sunday morning worship services, 2 Sunday schools, and a staff that was stressed out and nowhere else to grow. Over a period of about 2 years, we brought in consultants, we did internal studies trying to decide what should we do, what does God want us to do in terms of that growth. Our building and our acreage was just way beyond capacity. And so in 2006, we discerned that God was calling us to relocate the entire Highland Church. We looked at church planting, we looked at multi-site, but it was the judgment of the leadership that God was calling us to relocate en masse. And so 2006 was the year that we announced that. Hey, church, started here in 1928. Guess what? We're moving! All of you, 13 miles east, we're going to change from an urban location to a suburban location. And by the way, our long-term preaching minister is no longer here. So we began to hemorrhage members. And when you lose members, you also lose giving. And so financially, we began to go through just tremendous crisis, tremendous turmoil that lasted all 4 of those wonderful, wonderful years. So that's in a nutshell, that's the root of the decline that we went through. There's all sorts of reasons why churches go through the decline. Really not as interested in debating relocation and leadership transition, things like that. What I'm more interested in is this right here, and sharing how God brought that about for us, and perhaps how some of the things that we experience could be used by God where you are as well. I like this quote right here from a recent blog post by Ed Stetzer. He says, "Leadership, especially with church revitalization, what I'm calling reinvention, is a long and slow labor of love in the face of resistance. Not every member will be on your side during revitalization. If you want everyone to love you, go sell ice cream." Don't revitalize churches. And a hearty amen to that. It is difficult to revitalize, reinvent, turn around, break out. That's why most churches either die or stabilize at a smaller size. It's super hard, really, really hard. But it's worth it. It's worth it. That's part one, kind of those chapters in the life of the Highland Church in Memphis. I want to talk about four things that we focused on reinventing or renewing that we feel like God used to bring about that. These are not things necessarily that started in 2010. If you're going to experience a rebound, you have to start those things way back here in the midst of the decline and hope and faith that God's going to use those to bring that about. 4 things. Number 1, the reinvention of prayer. It was really striking to me at a recent gathering of our staff and elders. One of our elders said this. He said, "I sort of miss those hard times. We never prayed more as a leadership than we did back then." Now, that is crazy. Because the person who said this lived through all 4 of those years. And those were the hardest years that any of us had ever experienced in ministry. But I love that statement because he looked back on that with nostalgia, because that crisis drove us to our knees. And it really led to a spiritual renewal and a spiritual reinvigoration of both the leadership and of the church. Now, I would acknowledge that was really just a survival mode. It was a reflex. When someone is drowning, their reflex is to breathe. And when a church is in crisis, its reflex is to pray. So this was not the result of strategic meetings saying, how can we bring about turnaround. This was just survival. How do you survive in the midst of decline? We start to pray. And that's why I put this number one. Because I truly believe any turnaround is the result of the work of God.
Yes.
And this crisis drove us to our knees. I didn't read this line during those 4 years of decline. I read them afterwards, but it really made me think about what we were experiencing during that time. Eugene Peterson, in his book Pastor, talks about a friend of his who wanted to paint a picture, a portrait of him. The man knew that Eugene Peterson was a pastor, church leader. And so Peterson said, fine, you can paint my picture. And the day came for the painter to reveal to Peterson what the picture looked like. And Peterson said when he looked at it, he was shocked because it showed him gaunt, deathly white, dark and sunken features. And so he asked, that's not what Eugene Peterson looks like. And so he said, you know, what's the deal? Why did you paint me looking so terrible? And here's what the painter said. He said, I was painting you as you would look in 20 years if you insisted on being a pastor. Eugene, the church is an evil place. No matter how good you are and how good your intentions, the church will suck the soul out of you. Yeah, that's a pretty pessimistic statement about the church. But church decline will suck the soul out of you. And that's what we were experiencing during those 4 years of decline. And that's why it drove us to our knees. And every time we got together, our staff meetings, our staff elder meetings, they all just turned into prayer meetings. And we were no longer just doing the cursory, well, let's pray so we can get onto our agenda. It was now, let's just pray. Because we have no idea what to do in the midst of this. Prayer not only helped us deal with the confusion that was going on in the church around us, but it helped deal with the confusion that was going on inside of us. Henry Nouwen writes this. He says, anger in particular seems close to a professional vice in contemporary ministry. Pastors are angry at their leaders for not leading and at their followers for not following. They're angry at those who do not come to church for not coming, and angry at those who do come for coming without enthusiasm. They're angry at their families who make them feel guilty, and angry at themselves for not being who they want to be. If there's anything that makes the ministry look grim and dull, it is this dark, insidious anger in the servants of Christ. And that was certainly true for us. I guess I can only say it was certainly true for me. That as we began to experience this decline, not only was there confusion going on around us, but confusion going on within us, and this resentment and this bitterness that sets in. And prayer really became the lifeboat. It helped us through both that external storm and that internal storm. I think most of our leaders experienced spiritual renewal during that decline in a way that we never would have without that spiritual decline. John Ortberg, in more than one of his books, talks about how in a survey people were asked to identify what... Could you identify a time in your life when you grew the most? And by the vast majority, people pointed to a time of suffering. I suspect if we could ask churches, could you tell us the time when you grew the most? The same would be true. It was times of crisis. And that was certainly true for us. It was certainly true for me. So during those 4 years of decline, that really marked a major milestone in my own spiritual growth, my own spiritual development. That's when I began to seek outside counsel. That's when I really began to learn to pray, started praying through the Psalms, started learning centering prayer and contemplation and meditation. We were doing all sorts of things as a church. In the depth of that time of decline, we just had numerous times when we were calling the church together to pray, or just calling the church leaders together to pray. As we began to envision what would eventually become our new home, once it became clear where we were headed, one of the things that we designed was a prayer path around the new facility, around the new building. And at the time, I'm not sure that we understood the significance of that, but really what it was saying was that this new home is going to be encircled by prayer. prayer is going to encompass this new home. And I think that God was at work there. One year into our turnaround, I took 5 days and went on a silent retreat in Mobile, Alabama at a Jesuit college there as part of this ongoing effort to try to learn what it means to be a person and a leader of prayer. About the bottom and the beginning of the rebound, we launched a time of congregational prayer that eventually we came to call Vision 2018. And we just asked the church, 2018 is when we turn 90 as a church, 2018. So we just went to the church and we said, look, we need to be in prayer about our future as a church. Let's try to imagine 2018 when we turn 90. What do you think God wants to do through us? And as a whole church, we prayed through that, and people wrote things down, and we collected all that together, and it was a marvelous experience for us as a church. A couple years into our turnaround, I spent 30 days in silence, practicing the spiritual exercises of Ignatius of Loyola, and for me that was a transformative experience. 3 years into our turnaround, I wrote and preached through a book that I wrote called Prayers from the Pit, looking at the prayers of Jesus and calling the church to pray as Jesus prayed. 4 years in, I preached and then later wrote another book on spiritual transformation called 10-Minute Transformation. And that whole prayer emphasis continues into the present. We're now 5 years into our turnaround, and in 2 weeks I will have just finished spending 8 months every single week for 8 months with a group of Catholics in Memphis trying to learn how to pray. And that's been a transformative experience, a fascinating experience as well. We've had several prayer groups that have launched over the last 2 or 3 years. One of the groups that I led recently, we just prayed through that big thick book, Operation World, that lists every country and what Christian organizations and churches are involved, what hindrances to Christianity involved there, and we just kind of prayed through that. We began the year, this year, as we have over the last few years, with calling the staff and the elders together, and we went and prayed through every single room in our facility and for the ministry that takes place there. This year, I started in January, preached a sermon out of Jeremiah 29, where Jeremiah calls the exiles to pray for the city, pray for Babylon. And so every Wednesday night we've been praying for different parts of our city and the municipalities around us. All that to say that perhaps the greatest step that we took that allowed God to take His step was this step of prayer. And Barna says that's basically true in every situation. He says a turnaround church is resuscitated partly due to the widespread, heartfelt prayer that is lifted to God on the church's behalf. The pastor emerged as a true prayer giant, taking hours and hours every week to beseech God for all that was needed in the turnaround experience. The congregation was led to a place where it too embraced prayer as a special hidden weapon in the battle to turn back the forces of darkness that were pushing the church toward the edge of extinction. And I really like that, because I think it's easy, especially with church growth literature, it's really easy to kind of analyze and identify the blood and flesh stuff that we think is causing our church decline, when in reality it's a spiritual battle. Mm-hmm. It's spiritual forces of darkness. Because if Satan can kill the church, if he can cause the church to die, then wow, he's really gaining some ground. So this turnaround, breakout, revival, renewal, it's a spiritual enterprise. And really the first step for any church has got to be prayer. All right. We have 15 minutes. Awesome. We reinvented success. This was the second thing that we did. I think one of the most important things we did to experience revitalization was we began to change what we defined as success. It's an ongoing conversation. We've arrived at some conclusions that I'll share with you. We continue to tweak those conclusions. I think in some ways, this is going to be a lifelong project for Highland, trying to really determine what does it mean to be successful as a church. And again, just as with the prayer thing, this whole conversation wasn't some big strategic idea that we had. Well, if we do this, we'll experience a turnaround. This was just survival. Because when you're experiencing 4 years of decline and your budgets are being cut and your baptisms are going to single digits and there was a time in those 4 years when we didn't even have a building. For 2 years, we had no building. And there are fewer and fewer bottoms in the seats. If those are the ways that you're using to define success, then suddenly you feel like a total failure. And so it forced us to really begin to think, well, what exactly do we mean by success? Over those 4 years, we experienced what I call failure fatigue. I mean, just week after week after week, the things that we were looking at to define success, we were missing. We were missing the target, missing the mark. And we grew so weary of failing. And so we were forced to ask those questions again. If are these the things that we really want to hang our hat on? The number of Sunday morning worship services that we have, how many people we're baptizing, what the level of our financial giving is, and how many square feet we have in our building, and how many acres that we have. Not only was the leadership really struggling to define success, but the membership was struggling to define success as well. When you go through a period of decline after a period of growth, there's a strong tendency among the members and some leaders to say, well, if we only did things the way we did back then we'd experience growth again. And so there's this great sucking pull back to the glory days. And so success means, well, we need to restart that ministry. We need to rehire that person. We need to get back to that tradition. We need to start doing the things that we used to do those. Because when we did things that way, we grew. And so not only were the members struggling to define, the leaders struggling to define success, but so were the members. Over a period of really years, we began to try to think about what does it mean for us to win? What does it mean for us to succeed? Tom Rainer, again, in this book, Breakout Churches, here we go, mentions this conversation he has with a small church pastor. He says, the small church minister said, Dr. Rainer, I hear you're writing a book about breakout churches. I can't wait to read it, but I really don't have a desire to lead a megachurch. I hope your book will help pastors like me. It seems like what he was saying there was that the goal of breakout, the goal of rebounding, is to eventually become a megachurch. And that's the only reason for breakout. And I'm afraid some of that thinking was operating within us as well. That to succeed means to become a megachurch. So, eventually we landed on what we call seven practices. These are not flashy. These are simple, common sense kind of things. But now these are the things that we're trying to measure. Every year we do a little survey of the membership on these seven things. And these are the kind of victories that we're trying to celebrate now at Highland. And these are what we try to organize our calendar around. So we've had to institute a 3-week buffer in our church calendar around all major events, because what we found is there's so many great events going on that our membership didn't have time to engage in these seven practices. And so we thought, well, we have to reduce what we're doing as a church event-wise and give people more time to engage in these seven practices. So these are the things that we teach in our new member classes. We have posters with these all over the building. Slide right there, that's one of the posters. So we have these posters all over the building. And we say this is what we want to emphasize, because these are the kinds of practices we think will help you experience the more that you're meant for. That's kind of our tagline. So here's you're going to be amazed by the wisdom of these things. Number one, we want you to worship God in one of our Sunday morning services. We think that's important. We think God uses that. So we want to make sure you have time every Sunday to really focus on that. We want you to grow with others in one of our adult Sunday school classes. Woo, boy, that's rocket science. That's But we think that's important, and we want to make sure you have time to find community. That Sunday school is really where we do community. We're kind of Baptist in that sense. Number three, we want you to grow closer to God through personal spiritual disciplines, at least an hour a week. So we're going to organize things. We're not going to place so many demands on you that you don't even have time to pursue your own spiritual formation during the week. We want to make sure that you're engaged in personal spiritual disciplines throughout the week, and we're going to help you do that. We want you to serve in a ministry regularly. We want to make sure you have time to serve in a ministry with your gifts. So we're not going to crowd the calendar so full that you're coming to all these events and you never have time to serve. We think that's important. We want you to share Jesus through one of our small groups. So we think small groups are the best way to share Jesus with others, and we want you to be involved in one of those. We want you to give at least 10%. We want you to tithe to our collections, and we want you to share Jesus personally with others during the week. So we call those our seven practices, and those are the things that we're trying to really define as wins. So we're not talking here about attendance. We're not talking here about how big the building is. We're not even talking about baptisms here. We can't control how many people are baptized. We can encourage people to share Jesus. That's the best that we can do. So those are some of the practices and some of the ways that we've been redefining success at Highland. This is an ongoing conversation for us as a leadership, and I'm certain these seven practices will change over time as our own vision becomes clear. But I think it's a conversation that God used to help us experience turnaround and rebound and revitalization. Reinvention of leadership, number three. So from 1928 to about 2006, Highland operated with a leadership model that I will call the merry-go-round model of leadership. And in the merry-go-round model of leadership, there are two things in constant rotation. First, the elder chairman was in constant rotation. So from 1928 to about 2006, here's the way our leadership was structured. Elders were appointed for life. Every elder was deemed to have the skills and gifting necessary to be an elder chairman. Every elder chairman had the authority to call or not call leadership meetings, to decide what was or was not discussed at the meeting, and to decide how decisions were made at that meeting. And that chairmanship lasted 6 months. And so what you ended up with was a rotating list of elders sitting in the chair for 6 months at a time. And some of them were really good at it, and others were not called to that, not gifted for that. And that did two things to us. First, it created leadership log jams. So anytime a sensitive ministry issue came up, it was entirely dependent on which elder you had in the chair at the time and their ability or inability to lead the group through that sensitive ministry issue. So sometimes we'd have somebody in the chair who could lead the group successfully through that issue. At other times, we would not. And when your church is going through 4 years of decline, the number of sensitive ministry issues is staggering. And if you have somebody bad sitting in the chair for 6 months, you may as well just go on vacation, because nothing is getting done. So we're not talking here about character. We're talking here about competence and gifting. Another thing that did to us is that it resulted in a constant changing of boundaries within which ministry could flow. So this is what affected staff morale during those 4 years of decline. So the staff might decide, or staff might determine, that God is calling us to make some important change in the way we're doing ministry. But Elder Chairman A is on for six months, and we know he's going to veto that idea. And so we sit on it for 6 months and wait for Elder Chairman B to get there, because we know he's going to give us the thumbs up. Well, you can't operate a church that way. You can't run a staff that way. And you certainly can't deal with the church in decline that way. The problem was that each elder chairman was essentially ruling by his own preferences. And so if some ministry issue came up and was consistent with his preferences, green light. If it was not consistent with his preferences, thumbs down. So the fences within which ministry was taking place were constantly changing. And also that made it very difficult for us to deal with the grumbling and complaining. Believe it or not, when you're going through 4 years of decline, there's a lot of grumbling and complaining going on in the membership. And, it seemed like there were some weeks when absolutely nothing went well. They were complaining about which songs we sung, which songs we didn't sing, complaining about what I wore or what I didn't wear, about which ministries were starting, which ministries were stopping. And sometimes, depending on who was sitting in the elder chair, it took one strong critic to shut things down. So, finally, we decided that's not working. This is not working very well for us. And so we began to work with people like Lynn Anderson at the Hope Network, Edward Hufford, Harding School of Theology, Dickie Porsche, Ron Porsche's dad right there, and others from other churches to help us re-envision a better way of doing leadership. So what we were led to was we replaced this merry-go-round model with one that's focused on three things. Gift-based roles for elders, greater empowerment of staff, streamlined decision-making. So we checked the other model and came up with these three things as the core. So gift-based roles for elders. This meant that not every elder could sit in the chair, because not every elder was gifted for that. And through a still somewhat complex series of self-selection and peer selection, the elders themselves decide which of them have the gifting to be elder chairman. And only those elders are allowed to sit in the chair. The other elders are freed now to serve in other areas without having to worry about sitting in the chair and being in meetings where we talk about the color of the carpet and the color of the paint. We came up with what we call areas of service. So there's a pastoral area of service, and elders that have a strong pastoral gifting can spend their time pastoring and shepherding. There's a ministry area of service, and elders that really want to encourage leaders and build up new leaders can spend their time doing that. There's a missions area of service, and elders that are really interested and passionate for domestic and foreign missions can spend their time in that. So we restricted eldership roles in terms of leadership and administration. We expanded them in terms of these other areas of service. And so now elders are serving in areas in which they are gifted. Very, very helpful. We empowered the staff. Now, this happened through the development of a document that we came to call Core Beliefs and Values, where we tried to articulate our basic practices, our basic theology on a wide number of issues, everything from gender roles to leadership structures to theological priorities. This is a document that we hammered out during that decline. It was one of the most difficult things that we had ever done. But we finally came to agreement on basic theological priorities for the Highland Church. Every elder and every staff member agreed to serve under that theological set of priorities. Every new elder, every new staff member was required to agree to serve under that set of theological priorities. And for the staff, what it did is it empowered the staff, because it was basically pre-approval. Anything that you do within these fences, within these boundaries, do it with all your heart. You don't have to come to us to get approval for that. If there's anything outside of that, then let's come back together and talk about that. It helped us deal with the critics, because now if a critic came and talked to Elder A, that elder had some sympathy for the criticism, but it was something that was approved in the core beliefs and values, they would say, I'm really sorry about that. That's something the leadership has talked about already, and this is kind of where we stand on that. So God bless you. We help you stay. So it really helped us deal with the critic issue as well. The core beliefs and values is a living document. As we, continue to study and learn and grow in our own sense of what it means to be a church and function as a church. A couple of years ago, we had some issues arise about gender roles, and we had to go back to that document and go back to Scripture. We took about a year to study and pray and rethink what we had written there. We made some small changes in that, some small changes in practice there. That was a hard thing to do. We lost two elders over that and a few members over that. But we remained a united leadership about that. And a church in decline, if it's going to experience turnaround or revitalization, it's got to have a unified leadership. That was the second thing. Third thing, we're going to quit here. Streamline decision-making. So under the merry-go-round model of leadership, at least as it was practiced, basically you needed all the elders to make most of the decisions. We adopted a different model where we had a new staff elder administrative group, SEAG, it was called Staff Elder Administrative Group. Three elders, current chairman, upcoming chairman, former chairman. Three staff members, me, our associate preaching minister, the administrator. And we were authorized, empowered, to see to the day-to-day operations of the Highland Church and authorized to make certain decisions within that day-to-day operation. So decisions that once took months now took weeks. And especially when you're going through decline, the number of decisions that have to be made are really, really stacking up. So this streamlined that decision-making process. And again, I think helped bring about revitalization.
Can you name number four? Anyhow, you said there were four.
Yeah, the fourth one here. And I would say there's probably a good three or four more beyond this, but the one that I was going to mention, if we had time today, was the reinvention of the neighborhood. The nutshell here, one of the things that happened during those 20 years of growth was that we became focused very heavily on urban ministry. And we remain very focused on urban ministry. I would challenge anybody that says you can't do urban ministry from a suburban location. But one of the things that happened is we lost our focus on our immediate church neighborhood. We stopped caring about the people that lived around the building. And so one of the great things that God did through our decline was he forced us to ask again, well, what about the people around us? What are their needs? How can we serve them? What does it mean to be engaged in the neighborhood around us? And so now, on the other side of that turnaround, we continue to be heavily involved in urban ministry. We also now are heavily involved in neighborhood ministry in a lot of different ways. So again, all of this in more details on my website, chrisoutrock.com. You can pull that up. And I hope that our story is helpful for you, at least in encouragement to you. A turnaround does happen. God still resurrects the dead, and he can turn around churches. And we praise God for that. So thank you so much for your time today.